Welcome to Open Book on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is John Fisher, the artistic director of Theater Rhino in San Francisco. This is the first and hopefully a series of programs about theater groups around the Bay Area. In March, I'll be speaking with Tony Taccone of Berkeley Rep. This is the 30th anniversary year of Theater Rhino, been around for now 30 years. John, how long have you been the director, artistic director now?
In my sixth year now as artistic director.
What prompted you to stay in San Francisco 6 years ago? You know, you reached a point where you were beginning to develop a national career.
Well, the funny thing is that I think an artist needs a base, and that's what's been great about San Francisco, having that base. I'm now teaching at the Yale School of Drama, and I'm seeing my work done more and more off-Broadway in New York, and that's been great. But I think all of us have realized, and there's a number of people in this position, Tony, you mentioned, is now directing on Broadway, but Berkeley is his base. The Bay Area theater community is great. It's a great base because the audiences are interested. You can do all kinds of work here. I think if it were any other locality, it might be more of a challenge. But the Bay Area has worked very well for me, and I'm very dedicated to theater here.
Let's talk a little about Theater Rhino. How did it begin?
It had very humble beginnings. It began as a little theater troupe just putting up plays wherever. And the reason was there was no queer, no gay, lesbian representation. There was nothing to see. And in 1977, people wanted to see their lives on stage. So this little theater troupe came out and did these plays. And they were at first very weird. They were very strange alternative plays. And then they became more and more representational of queer lives. So it was that need, that mid-70s need to see our lives on stage.
And what happened? How did it develop to a point where you took it over? When did it move into its current digs at 16th right off Mission?
It's been there for 25 years. And I was just a working artist there. I did a play called Barebacking, which was a very nasty production about unprotected sex, and it had scat in it and bathhouses and all that stuff, and it was a big hit. So they kept asking me to come back and do shows. And then when the previous artistic director decided to step down, the board asked me if I wanted to take over, and I said yes, happily.
All right, before we talk a little more about Theater Rhino, let's talk about you, John Fisher. Were you always interested in theater even as a kid? And are you from the Bay Area?
I'm from the Bay Area. I'm from Ross, California. In Marin County, I went to Redwood High, and when I got to high school, I got myself into a high school musical. It was called The Boyfriend. I had the smallest role in the show, and I was smitten. I loved it. I thought it was great, and from then on, I've been involved in theater.
You were at Berkeley.
I went to UC Berkeley. I got my BA, my MA, and my PhD all from Berkeley.
And what was your first play?
That I wrote? It was called A History of Homosexuality in Six Scenes. And I think like every young gay person, I wanted to create a history for myself because there wasn't a history for myself. So I wrote a play, and it was all about how Jesus was gay, and the Greeks were all gay, and the Romans were all gay, and basically everybody in history was gay.
Did that wind up getting performed not just in the Bay Area but elsewhere?
Well, it was a big hit. Everybody just thought it was a hoot, and we did it in the city at the Bayfront Theater, and then we kept moving it because it was a hit to the Actors Theater. And it has not been performed outside of San Francisco. And I think the reason might be that, like I say, every gay playwright writes is everybody in history has been gay play. So I think every locality has its everybody in history has been gay play. So it's probably not the play that would travel best. Although I think it'd do well on TV because it's very sketch comedy-ish.
When you talk about TV and sketch comedy-ish, was there any sense that you might want to go at that point to L.A. and try to get involved in TV?
The funny thing is I'm a great fan of movies. I mean, nobody loves movies more than me, and I'm sort of a provisional fan of television, but I just never – it's never been my thing. And now I have a screenplay that I've written that people are talking about actually making into a movie, so it might become my thing, but it hasn't been so far.
At what point did Madea the musical come along?
Well, we did a play called The Joy of Gay Sex, which was also a big success. And then we took a big leap and did Madea the Musical, which was a much bigger project than we'd ever done before.
When you say we?
My producer, John Zimmerman, and I. So he was the guy who did all these things. And he basically did them because he was an undergraduate and he didn't want to get a job. So he was going to produce my plays in San Francisco and live off the box office. I was like, great. That's exactly what you want in a producer. Somebody who's hungry, who needs to buy some groceries. So John kept producing these plays, and he did a great job at it. And finally, we did Medea the Musical, and I think that that was the one we thought, well, now the gig is up. Because the night before it opened, we thought, nobody's going to fall for this. This thing is like a mess. I mean, the plot keeps changing. It's a musical sometimes. It's a play other times. It's direct address at other times. I mean, we thought it was just like a horrible, like bad lasagna. Like everything had been thrown into the pot.
Including you playing the director
back of the house. Like nobody's going to think this is funny. Nobody's going to know what's going on. It's going to be confusion. And we really, I mean, the night before opening, and we were doing that at this theater. And the owners of the theater went crazy and tried to throw us out on the street the night before it opened.
What theater was it?
I'm not going to tell you. but anyway, it was scary. It was a very scary thing. And then we opened it, and it just had like this incredible energy behind it. And I don't take all credit for that. I think a lot of it had to do with the cast and their friends. And the cast were like super young. Some of them were undergraduates still. Some of them were 18. The old one in the cast was Paul Tenna, who was like all of 23. And then there was me, the old, old guy, 29. I think there was just sort of like this weird kind of young thing happened where kids who knew wanted to come see a play. Also, it was the mid-90s, so there was this whole sort of like metrosexual. Everybody on the planet was interested in all kinds of sexuality. There was all this money. People wanted to go see plays. And the thing just for about 15 different reasons took off. And it was shocking. I mean, I really thought the jig was up. I thought, you know, they've had it with this gay guy who writing plays about metrosexuality, and this one is the biggest mess of all time. But it turned out to be a much bigger success than anything we'd done before.
It's now gone out and been played in many places.
Yeah, it seems to be the magic number for me. Everywhere it goes, people seem to love it. And again, it's like it's an amalgamation of things. It's a lot of it's still that kind of youthful kind of drive and energy. And everywhere we do it, we use a different cast and we use the actors' real names. So I think it has that kind of sense of like the Mary Tyler Moore Show where, you know, you're not really watching actors. You're watching, you know, the real people up there. And there's always that fun confusion about it.
Did it ever play in New York?
It has not played in New York. And it's funny because I think there's a group of us who have musicals that we think would go over super well in New York. And they haven't quite made it there. And I think the reason is the deal just hasn't sounded right to me. I'm very protective of it. And I'm afraid, and this is going to sound really stupid and perverse, but I'm afraid of the Nathan Lane factor. Like, oh, Nathan Lane would be great in the leading role. And I'm sort of like, you know, which probably makes me sound like the stupidest playwright of all time.
Well, after that, you did Titus Andronicus, right?
We did a musical, Titus Andronicus, called Titus. It was done outdoors, and the audience moved around. Again, the night before opening, I thought, oh, my God, this is a disaster. Nobody's going to come see this. And it turned out we just had droves of people following us around Yerba Buena Gardens in the freezing cold. I don't know whoever thought of summer Shakespeare, outdoor Shakespeare in San Francisco, but we did it anyway. And it was basically a massive musical about the story of Titus Andronicus.
You're listening to an interview with John Fisher, who's the artistic director of Theater Rhino in San Francisco. How many plays have you written and directed since you joined Rhino?
Probably about 10, probably far too many. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a thing. I love to direct my own work, and I think I'm the best director to do the first crack at my shows because I'm also learning about them. It's funny you mentioned Titus because Titus was – people think it was just this dumb musical, but it was really about what we're going through now. It was about invading a foreign country, exploiting the hell out of it, and that allows us to provide, you know, fun things like health care and grants for the arts. It was really about imperialism. I think some people got that. Other people just thought it was like a bunch of fun musical numbers.
Well, once you joined Theater Rhino and you began working within Theater Rhino, it meant that there had to be some kind of gay or lesbian thematic element to the plays that you're directing or starring in or writing. Is that limiting? Do you do work elsewhere too?
Yeah, I've had a lot of luck actually being able to direct plays away from Theater Rhinoceros that have no queer content. And I've actually tried to stretch the idea of queer content to talk about all kinds of things. Like, I don't want to just talk about what's going on in gay life. I want to talk about what's going on in Iraq. I mean, how can you talk about anything else right now? And so how do we inject the queer into Iraq so that we can say we have a perspective on this as well? I think my next project is my first real complete break with the idea that there has to be some queer content, and that's Ishii, in which the story of Ishii and Alfred Kroeber is being told straight. There is no deliberate queer insertion into the narrative. I consider it a queer project because I'm queer, just as a lot of plastic artists are considered queer simply because they're queer. There's no queer content in what they do. I've really tried to make that leap, and we'll see how it goes. I mean, I might get fired by the board.
That's scheduled at Theater Rhino in July, right?
That's scheduled at Theater Rhino in July, and really there's nothing queer about it except me.
Well, let's talk about what's happening now. I know you did Staircase.
We did Staircase.
Which was because you couldn't get boys in the band?
Well, that was the ostensible reason. I always have a bunch of plays in the back of my mind that I always wanted to do, and Staircase was one of them. So we did that, and which was great because I thought it was lost and it needed to be brought back into the public eye. And I love the production, the actors I worked with, I just was in love with. And now we're doing kind of the opposite, which is that was the all-boys show. Now we're doing the all-women show, which is Boston Marriage by David Mamet.
But there's something else going on there, too, because you're also doing a second David Mamet called The Shawl.
That's right. We're doing a mini Mamet festival.
Is that one? Does that one have gay themes in it?
It is. It's about a medium, a clairvoyant, and he is trying to keep a hustler who's living with him. And the hustler gets him, talks him into doing some phony clairvoyance. And so they try to scam a woman, a young woman who's emotionally needy. It really is, except for the cryptogram, the only queer content play. I mean, that's it for David Mamet. That's Boston Marriage, Cryptogram, and The Shawl. So we're doing the other two gay plays.
Now let's talk a little about Boston Marriage because it has not played here in the Bay Area. Right?
It has not.
It was first performed, I think, in 1999 and
right.
Eventually hit New York in 2002. And you're the director. How does it feel directing Mamet? I know it's women, but it's still Mamet. It's still that.
Right.
Does that change your own work as a director, knowing that you're dealing with a certain kind of dialogue?
I've always been a huge fan of David Mamet. I wrote my undergraduate thesis on David Mamet, and I've always been intrigued and excited by his dialogue. I entered into this as a collaboration with the actresses, and fortunately I found three very intelligent, intuitive actresses, and we've really, really struggled, in the best sense of the word, to fulfill David's vision of these characters.
Did you have any contact with Mamet himself?
No. I mean, it would have been lovely to, but we're talking about a guy who's opening a show on Broadway and directing 16 films and running a TV series. I mean, I just, you know, he's busy, I'm busy. So I figured it was the better part of wisdom for the children to
right.
entertain themselves. The beautiful thing about Mamet's writing is it's always interesting. David never settles for the mundane. He never tries to create reality through peace, through the ordinary. David is always jarring you. And I think the great thing about the cast of this production is they've found the language to be liberating. It allows them to explore the characters in a way they've never been allowed to before, because in most plays, the language is either everyday or it's highly stylized. David won't settle for either. He won't settle for Shakespeare. He won't settle for Neil Simon. He will bounce back and forth, and keep tossing a little Martin Scorsese in there all along the way. And that's what's so exciting about his writing, and this play especially, because it's a whole new subject matter for him, writing about lesbians.
And it's also a historical era, which changes it as well.
David set himself the task to write a lesbian play in a lesbian manner, and the manner he chose is Oscar Wilde. He is writing in the voice of Oscar Wilde, writing a play about women in love. I so admire somebody setting themselves those challenges. I mean, you're talking about the most successful American playwright now writing. You know, he could just be banging out Boulevard farces. But he's always testing himself. And this, I think, is one of his greatest tests over the last decade, both in terms of subject matter, in terms of style. It's nothing like anything he's ever written.
I saw a production of his I guess, translation of Dr. Faustus at the Magic,
that's
and it
right.
was ghastly.
But you see, that's the thing about David, is he will do these Chekhov adaptations. He'll do this Faust. He is hungry for work. He sees the playwright as a cobbler, somebody who gets up and works an 8-hour day, a 10-hour day. And what that means is that he can write a lot and do whatever he wants and not be afraid of something being ghastly. And I admire that. I mean, when you think of like Arthur Miller every 10 years squeezing out a play, I mean, there's, I don't want to say it's fear, but there's trepidation there. There's nothing fearful about David.
Well, what about you? When you're writing, do you kind of look at that as a model that you try to pursue?
Absolutely. I don't write like David Mamet. His typical subject matter and the way he forms a scene are not my inspirations, but his work ethic and his, what's the word, promiscuity, his desire to do everything inspire me enormously, like Shakespeare. I mean, just this willfulness, this ambition. And he has said, you know, during that whole debacle, I don't know if you read this great New Yorker article maybe 10 years ago about that production that he collaborated on with Woody Allen and Elaine May, and how at one point they thought it was going to be this huge flop, and they called him up on the phone and they said, are you worried? And he said, haven't you ever had a flop before? Just this blithe understanding that A Life in the Theater, one of his great plays, A Life in the Theater is composed of all kinds of experiences. You can't control them. All you can control is what you want to do. And he always lets himself do what he wants to do.
So to that degree, John Fisher, on any Theater Rhino production, you're not afraid to fail?
I'm not afraid to fail if I feel like we have integrity in the choice and in the manner in which we approach the product. And I always feel we do. I don't do things I don't want to do. Our theater is always ambitious in terms of subject matter, in terms of casting, in terms of the type of show we do.
Now, what about these various one-man or multi-man, sort of one-man shows, like the one that I just saw, Shark Bites,
uh-huh.
or there's one coming up called Seven Sins. Where do they fit into the scope of Rhino?
Well, Jeffrey Hargraves is an actor who's worked with us for years, and we love Jeffrey. And he underwent a massive life change recently because of a bout with cancer. And he wrote this one-man show to talk about his cancer. But then he decided that it really wasn't a one-man show because it involved his friends, who are the people who got him through this event. And so he put those actual friends on stage. And again, this is like getting back to Medea the musical. It's something beyond theater, I feel, because the real people are playing themselves. And it's something beyond a one-man show because there's a lot more men up there. The wonderful thing about Shark Bites is the audience is attracted, and this is what excites me about our theater, isn't just gay men or lesbian women. It's people who are dealing with cancer. And here I feel like we're moving out into other realms of experience that transcend just the queer experience. And that's what excited me about that project. And that is really a Theater Rhinoceros co-production. We facilitated it. We allowed it to happen. We allowed it to develop. Seven Sins is a wonderful show that's coming from another city. And it's really just a visitor. And, of course, it's happening at Theater Rhinoceros, so it's a visitor that we like. But it's a visitor.
Well, how do you make those kinds of determinations about this is a visitor or we're going to make a co-production or it's going to be an exclusive Rhino production?
Well, I think the thing about Seven Sins is that it's finished. We didn't have to develop it. This is really something that's done and ready to be seen. With Shark Bites, we really had to facilitate its creation, and that's a greater leap of faith.
How do you deal with a very successful show that you want to continue? I assume that if a show is really bad, it's still going to do the run. I mean, not
right.
bad in terms of the quality, but in terms of the audience response.
The audience response.
Yeah.
If a show does well, we bring it back. Sometimes we're able to extend just beyond the original run. Other times we have to shut the show down because something else has to come in, but then we bring it back later. That's what happened with Shark Bites. It's happened with a number of our productions.
And in terms of capitalization, are you generally running at a loss because it's a nonprofit, or do these shows break even? Do they make money? How does that work?
The goal of any show is to break even on its production costs, and then it's the donations and foundation support that keep the infrastructure going.
Say on an average show in the upper theater, you know, what percentage of the auditorium needs to be filled to achieve that goal, you think?
60%.
And it's just Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then Sunday matinee, right?
It's Wednesday through Saturday.
Wednesday through Saturday.
And then Sunday matinee. So it's five shows a week. We need to operate about 60% to break even. Some shows will operate under, but then other shows will operate way over. You talk about a show like Margot Gomez or Medea the Musical when we did it. These are shows we're selling out.
And I would guess a Mammoth Festival probably do very well for that reason.
Mammoth's a name playwright, and that's always clever. Our interest in Mammoth in this instance is that his work hasn't been seen. In other words, I won't just put on Mammoth because, you know, he'll make money. I like this Mammoth because he hasn't been seen locally yet.
How do you think Boston Marriage fits in the broader Mammoth? I mean, like, where does it in the middle, at toward the upper end?
In terms of quality?
Yeah.
I think it's the master. I think it's not the Sistine Chapel, but it's the – I'm lost in my analogy. It's one of Michelangelo's other masterpieces. It's him truly in his element. His career has grown. When I wrote about him as an undergraduate, which was a long time ago, I felt like he hadn't quite mastered plot yet. He had character. He had relationship. He even had situation, but he didn't have plot. A play like American Buffalo really doesn't have much of a plot, or the plot is almost an afterthought. This resides in his great plot era, where I feel like it's become everything about plot for him. He's really added these baroque, complicated plots to his already baroque, complicated characters.
And that's running at Theater Rhino through...
It runs through March 2nd, 2008.
The other one, The Shawl, is very limited run.
That's two weekends only.
Why so short?
It was really a case of having the space available and wanting to do something in it, and that's the window we had.
Is it like a one-act or full-length play?
It's a one-act play. It's about 45 minutes long. The price for The Shawl is lower.
How far ahead do you plan? Like, what are you looking at now for the future? I mean, are you looking at 2009, 2010?
Sure. There's a show we want to do that we're really excited about, and, you know, I think the rights battle is going to take a long time, and that's La Cage aux Folles. Now, when I say that, remember that there's been a movie of La Cage aux Folles. There's been a musical of La Cage aux Folles. But there's never been an English-language production of the play. The problem is getting the rights, getting the permission to do a translation. And we've actually already commissioned and had done a literal translation. And then what I want to do is make that into a performable comedy.
When you're looking back over the history of queer theater, it seems like most of the older plays are oppressed gay people in their society, plays
right.
like Boys in the Band or Staircase.
Absolutely.
At what point do you think there was a switch, a change into a different world? And also, were there any early plays that did not have that outlook?
It's a very interesting question. I think there were plays that didn't have that outlook, but that outlook arose from almost a very early, like, we're not talking about it, so we can't be oppressed. There's an old play called The Green Bay Tree, which played on Broadway, which is really the first play about homosexuality openly. The word doesn't exist, so there's no way to oppress these people. World War II creates the word and solidifies it and makes it a crime. And it's very interesting. I think things change with AIDS. I think the era of whining about oppression ends with AIDS, because I think when people realize just how awful the disease was and the oppression of treatment could be, they realized almost retrospectively, look at all that we've gained, and we're fighting a battle beyond acceptance. We're fighting a battle for survival based on getting proper support from the government, which in a way assumes acceptance. And in that way, I mean, the AIDS crisis is the worst thing that has happened to this country, I feel, ever internally. It's such a challenge since the Civil War almost, and the civil rights movement. The AIDS crisis ranks with those as a real challenge to all of us. But the great thing that came from it is I think it made the queer movement realize how much it had gained.
I think it also made society realize, because when people like Rock Hudson and Michael Bennett die, suddenly someone has to say, you know, we're going to lose a tremendous amount of the entertainment and arts industry.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a resource like Michael Bennett, when you think of what he had ahead of him. What is he, 47 or something? I'm just saying, a young man. And you think of what somebody like Bob Fosse created between 47 and his death. I mean, this guy's gone. And I think that it's no accident that with his death, the musical theater, the world's musical theater movement shifts to England. Trevor Nunn, the big English musical. And that was America's, I think, greatest tragedy culturally was AIDS. An awful tragedy and embarrassing. I think we should feel embarrassed as Americans the way that we dealt with it and are still dealing with it to a certain extent. But as you point out, I think it did wake people up to, if we have accepted queerdom in this country, what are we going to do beyond acceptance to nurture it?
Are you tired of plays about AIDS too, though?
I'm not tired of them. I think a lot's been said on the subject, and I think that there are new things to say on the subject than there are old things. Old's a bad word in our culture, and it shouldn't be, but by old I simply mean it's been said before.
So you don't foresee yourself bringing plays like The Normal Heart back?
The Normal Heart's an incredible play. I mean, at some point, writing transcends subject matter. And I think that The Normal Heart's politics are old. I think its dramaturgy is breathtaking. And so that might even merit a revival.
You've been listening to an interview with John Fisher, artistic director of Theater Rhino. Current production, Boston Marriage by David Mamet, is playing for the next month. And The Shawl is playing February 21st to March 1st. More information about Theater Rhino, go to the website, therhino.org. Theater Rhino's phone number?
861-5079 in the 415 area code.
I'm Richard Walensky on Open Book.